stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Chicago actor Jeff Parker, who is starring as Henry Higgins in the Oslo Repertory Theater production of My Fair Lady. I'm also playing a review of the show by Sharon Leslie and two of the songs from the original production, in which you will hear Rex Harrison doing the songs you will hear Jeff Parker doing when you go to see the show. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down. Finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Finding and discovering and knowing and then being able to use what you know about yourself. As I say in virtually every show, you wouldn't think this would be such a tricky thing. You hear people saying all the time, well, that's just who I am. I can't do what I can't do. I can't be who I'm not. Oh yeah, it would be nice if I could do that or be that or have that quality, but I'm just not that. Well, I don't actually believe that. I'm a psychotherapist, and my experience in my practice is that we come out of childhood with an idea about ourselves, and while that idea is usually the truth, it's not the whole truth. We have been encouraged, dissuaded, manipulated, scared, whatever term you want to use, into presenting certain aspects of ourselves, the ones that somehow seem to work in our system, and hiding other aspects of ourselves. And I call the one that we present, our cover story, and the one we hide, our undercover. We promptly forget that we have those things that we have hidden undercover, so when we say, that's just who I am and I can't be anything else, we really mean it. But that still doesn't make it the truth. Undercover, we may very well have the quality that we are saying we don't have, the one we want and quite often actually need in order to be the best person that we can be. And I don't mean this best in terms of good and bad. I mean the most of ourselves that we can be. And life is the most comfortable when we are using all of who we are. So to demonstrate what this sounds like, I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist, where I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because in order to do that is make a living or a life with an art in our culture, it has to be who you really are. We do not make it easy for people to give a life to an art. And so in order to do it, as you have heard many of the artists that I talk to, they say, I can't do anything else. This is all there is. This is who I am. And when you hear them, you hear what we therapists call congruence. What you hear is what you got. It's the real thing. And these people, at least in the area of their work, are who they are. And when you hear them, it is my hope that some aspect of yourself, which has been hiding, will stand up and say, here I am, see me, know me. You can learn more about what I think about how you become who you really are, how you discover what you might have hidden, by going to my website, thelynnshow.com. That's THELYNNE, don't leave out the E, SHOW, thelynnshow.com. I wrote a book in which I talk about it, and you can hear a little piece of the audiobook at my website. You can also hear all of the interviews that I've done over the past 3 years. But now I'm going to play Sharon Leslie's review of My Fair Lady. And after that, I'm going to play a song from the original production. This is being sung by Rex Harrison, who was in the movie, you may have remembered, and I believe also in the Broadway production. The song is Why Can't the English? You will hear Jeff and I talking about the remarkable lyrics in My Fair Lady, the just glorious, glorious songs. So you won't hear Jeff, but you will hear the song, and I hope that both the review and the song and the interview will make you run right out and see this production. It is so well worth it. So here, Sharon Leslie's review, followed by Rex Harrison singing Why Can't the English, followed by my interview with Jeff Parker.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie with a review of My Fair Lady. When Eliza says, ow, in the first moments of My Fair Lady, you know you are getting on a roller coaster of a theatrical ride. This thrilling production of a much-loved musical theater classic is stunning to look at and exciting to experience. The Oslo Repertory Theater has put together a skilled creative team from top to bottom and a marvelous cast. How often have you seen My Fair Lady, perhaps hummed the tunes, and generally been amused by the gender tug-of-war, or as it wills, of Professor Henry Higgins and his elocution student, Eliza Doolittle? What began as a marvelous play by George Bernard Shaw is elevated to even greater heights by the songs of Lerner and Lowe. This piece is a classic because the struggle to improve one's condition and finding a teacher to help is an ongoing human challenge. On this ride, Ugly Duckling Eliza is willing to undergo an extreme makeover by Professor Higgins. I compare My Fair Lady to a roller coaster because the book and score are about going through the extreme ups and downs, twists and turns, and loop-de-loops of life without falling off the tracks. Within this very stylized library where knowledge and study are revered, all kinds of hell breaks loose. My Fair Lady is about the juxtaposition of extremes, lower class, upper class, convention, unconvention, discipline, abuse, male, female, love, hate, and above all, the recognition of oneself by another. The Oslo production relishes the dramatic contrasts. The hardest part about doing the show is the casting. finding two exquisitely balanced performers who can handle the difficult leads. Jeff Parker is excellent as Henry Higgins. He smoothly handles the fire and ice that the cultured intellectual Higgins denies he is capable of. Parker sings well, speaks impeccably, and bullies Eliza deliciously. As Eliza, Andrea Prestonario shows the crackling fire that needs to be tamed in order to improve herself. She sings with skill and passion. As Alfred Doolittle, Andrew Boyer is delightfully conniving and charming. Joel Hatch, as the gentlemanly Pickering, is the emotional anchor of the show. Peggy Roeder, as Mrs. Higgins, is scene-stealing as she puts her son, Henry, in his place. Sean Effinger Dean is youthfully exuberant as Freddie and sings On the Street Where You Live just exquisitely. And the housekeeper, Mrs. Pierce, is played by Penny Slusher, is a much stronger character than usual and makes the whole piece work better. Two pianos expertly accompany this chamber version of the musical. Since I love a piano, I was happy. So much else to applaud. The costumes were spot on, visually evocative of each scene, class of each character, and displayed an original flair for the Ascot scene. I won't tell you what it is because it's worth watching. The set was sleek, quick with the multiple changes of locale, wonderful to watch, yet never overpowering the action. Most of all, the direction by Tony Award-winning Frank Galati is to be bowed down to once again. He directed the much-lauded 12 Angry Men last season, and this season he has done it again with My Fair Lady. Mr. Galati has a genius for creating a visual appropriate for each scene while at the same time bringing out the human aspects of the writing and allowing those emotional moments to shine. We go to see and hear familiar stories and music over and over again because with each ride, something new is discovered and an important lesson, perhaps, is relearned. This production of My Fair Lady is well worth seeing for the first, second, or 100th time.
Look at her, a prisoner of the gutter, condemned by every syllable she uttered. By right, she should be taken out and hung for the cold-blooded murder of the English tongue.
Ow!
Ow! Heavens, what a noise! This is what the British population calls an elementary education.
Oh, come, sir, I think you picked a poor example.
Did I? Hear them down in Soho Square, dropping H's everywhere, speaking English any way they like. You, sir, did you go to school?
What do you type me for, a fool?
No one taught him take instead of type. Hear a Yorkshireman, or worse, hear a Cornishman converse. I'd rather hear a choir singing flat. Chickens cackling in a barn, just like this one.
Gom.
Gom. I ask you, sir, what sort of word is that? It's ow and gone that keep her in her place. Not her wretched clothes and dirty face. Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? This verbal class distinction by now should be antique. If you spoke as she does, sir, instead of the way you do, why, you might be selling flowers too.
I beg your pardon, sir.
An Englishman's way of speaking absolutely classifies him. The moment he talks, he makes some other Englishman despise him. One common language I'm afraid we'll never get. Oh, why can't the English learn to set a good example to people whose English is painful to your ears? The Scotch and the Irish leave you close to tears. There even are places where English completely disappears. In America, they haven't used it for years. Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? Norwegians learn Norwegian. The Greeks are taught their Greek. In France, every Frenchman knows his language from A to Z. The French don't care what they do, actually, as long as they pronounce it properly. Arabians learn Arabian with the speed of summer lightning, and the Hebrews learn it backwards, which is absolutely frightening. But use proper English, you're regarded as a freak. Oh, why can't the English? Why can't the English learn to speak?
Okay, so I'm here with Jeff Parker in the mezzanine at the Oslo. And Jeff is Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And I always ask them the same question.
Sure.
And it is.
Okay.
How did it start for you? What was the very first moment in your life that you thought, I'd like to be an actor, a performer, a singer. I like it when people look at me, listen to me, laugh at me. Any of that?
Most likely, it was a community theater production of The Music Man when I was 9 years old.
Okay, so how did you wind up auditioning?
It was our church. My parents, a Catholic parish in Sherman Oaks, California. My parents were part of a group of adults who wanted to put on a show.
They weren't professional?
They were not, no.
But of course you were in Hollywood.
I grew up in Southern California in the entertainment community. My dad does work in the motion picture industry. On the technical side,
mm-hmm.
He with family business, we manufacture motion picture lighting equipment.
Uh-huh.
For the studio, so dad would always provide lighting equipment for any conceivable parish function.
Oh, good for him.
You know, whether
yes,
it was a potluck
right, we're doing
or a show,
right,
anything.
Right.
It was his way of, you know, giving back to the community.
Uh-huh.
So, but he and my mom had been performers in a youth group at the church. I went to the same schools as my folks did.
Okay, so it's in the system, although not thought of as a profession necessarily. Just this is a lot of fun. We love to do this thing.
That's right. So they decided to do a production of The Music Man. My mom was sort of the producer, so I had an in. and I got to play Winthrop in The Music Man. And I would say that was the first real... I had done some kids, you know, sort of kid shows up until that point for a couple of years. But that was first time working with adults.
Mm-hmm.
And... that was the hook. I mean, that was the
so
hook.
So you remember it?
Oh, as clear as day. Yeah. And I have the videotape to prove it.
Oh, yeah.
It was in the very early days of videotape.
Nonetheless.
So actually on 3/4-inch tape, studio-grade tape. It's very grainy to look at now, but it was such a thrill. And I think there was something about getting to play with the adults
right.
that really appealed to me as a kid. I do recall responding to the thrill of being before an audience. That was very, very exciting to mm-hmm. me. I don't think at 9 years old I was thinking, I'm going to go in this as a profession. I was just a kid doing it,
yeah.
enjoying it, and responding to that.
Yeah, okay. So 9 years old, you have what turns out to be a very pivotal experience in your life, whether you knew it or not, right?
Right.
So. How did you get from there to here? What happened next?
I continued to do these shows, these community theater shows. I continued to do I was in the Saturday workshop with this great guy from the community who was an actor named Richard Galley, and he would have the kids in on a Saturday, and it was just one day a week, and we would put on a show. But when we did Fiddler, we did Grease, we did Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And, you know, so I continued to do that with kids, also doing the community shows, and then continued to do it through high school. And then I happened to do a summer program at the National High School Institute at Northwestern University called the Cherub Program, which is a summer high school theater program for high school students, obviously for high school. But you can only do once. You can only do it between your junior and senior year of high school. And at Northwestern, it is really like any of like you would do a pre-college program. It's designed to give a high school student an early taste of what the college experience would be like, except in this case, specifically geared towards theater. That introduces me to Chicago. I go to do this summer program.
Okay, one step
sure.
again. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, this is, as you said, designed to give kids a leg up into theater,
mm-hmm.
right? So did your parents know that?
Oh, sure.
So yeah. By that time, were you already considering this as a possible?
As I started in high school, and you start thinking about what you might study in college. Then it started to become a very real possibility.
Okay,
for
was
me.
There ever anything else that?
Was it was that or going into the family business.
Business, yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
So you said at some point to your parents, you know, I'm really thinking about this. I'd like to go to this thing.
Yeah, actually, I don't know that it was that clear.
Ah.
I think my dad heard about the program from somewhere.
And said, what do you
think? Said it to me, have you heard about this program at Northwestern? Then I think I started asking around a couple of friends that maybe had done it. I don't really remember. But we decided to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to credit my parents for not discouraging it.
Yeah, right.
And my dad, I'll never forget, he put me on the plane at Burbank Airport. And it was the first time.
Oh, and you were young?
Yeah, 16.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been on a plane before, but I'd not gone away from home for that length of time. Mm-hmm. And I still teach in this program to this day. So that was a big step for both of us. And then it was by doing that program that, with other students who were as passionate and as interested as I. For the first time, you're with 125 kids.
And most of them think this is going to be their career.
Right.
They're there for, right?
And if not as performers, somewhere in it,
yeah.
Somewhere in making theater.
Right, right.
And so I was introduced to Northwestern. I didn't go to Northwestern, but I was introduced to Chicago theater, most importantly. And it was, we did a field trip into the city, and we went to Steppenwolf and saw a production of Sam Shepard's Fool for Love with Tony winner Rondi Reed, who I now know is considered sort of a colleague in Chicago, and William Peterson from both affiliated with Steppenwolf, and he's known for CSI, the original CSI series. So I'm seeing them, and they weren't stars at the time, but seeing them do Sam Shepard in a very intimate space, aggressive, physical, emotionally connected, unlike anything I had seen in the sort of Equity Waiver scene in Los Angeles growing up. So I saw a fair amount of theater locally, professional, but not with the vibe and energy and intensity that you see in Chicago. Just rocked my world at 16. All of us that watched that production, incredible. So that, file that away, I finish this program, I come home, finish high school my senior year, and I decide to stay in Los Angeles. That was what it felt right to me, and I go to USC and decide to audition for a conservatory program, get in, and then do 4 years of actor training at USC.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a year after that, sort of kicking around L.A., working for the family business, Chicago still sort of calling. I go back to teach in that same summer program.
Now, I'm just curious.
Sure.
Did you have to audition for that? Did you have to write them and say, I'd like to teach here? Do they...
Backing up a little bit, while I was an undergraduate, they had a limited number of undergraduate, like, teaching assistant
mm-hmm.
positions. So in a similar way to when I was in high school, you could return to this program and apply to be a TA, or
mm-hmm.
what they call a faculty associate. And I got hired to do that, so I went back and, you know, in the midst of my undergraduate experience,
right.
had another Chicago experience.
Right.
Come home, finish college.
And Chicago sort of...
It keeps reinserting itself.
Right.
And so
right.
I applied to teach again,
mm-hmm.
because I wanted more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go back, and that's, you know, a couple of years later, about a year after I was out of college, go back, teach again. I'm 23. And while I'm there that summer, and getting to a lot of the teachers on that faculty were Chicago professionals,
right.
local theater professionals. Stage manager, her name's Julie Walker. She's still a stage manager in the area. And she was working at a theater called Drury Lane Oakbrook. And she says, why don't you, we had a day off or something, and she said, why don't you come see the show at my theater, where I work during the year. So they're doing Nonsense. I said, oh, well, that sounds like fun, let's go do that. As I'm getting in the car, because we're driving from Chicago to the suburbs, She said, oh, by the way, you better go get your music because I've arranged an audition for you at the theater for our next show. I was like, what? And she said, we just lost a guy and we need a non-equity, a non-union actor to fill this slot because he got another show. He had to drop out. I've arranged an audition for the musical director. So I go out there and I see the show, see Nonsense, which, you know, that was enjoyable. And then go backstage. Actors are getting their food. They're heating it up in the microwave. And they say, come on out here onto stage, where the musical director was there to piano, and I sang. And then,
what did you sing?
I think I sang On the Street Where You Live.
Surprisingly enough.
Yeah. And I was in my book for many, many years after that. And they said, a few days later, they said, we want you to do this. And it was a show called On the 20th Century that, interestingly enough, Peggy Roeder, who plays Mrs. Higgins in the production, she was also in that production then. And I took the job. I had a plane ticket home to Los Angeles. I never used it.
Wow.
And I stayed in Los Angeles.
I met my wife. You mean you stayed
in Chicago? I stayed in Chicago. And met my wife that summer, the woman who would be my wife that summer.
Wow.
And I never went home. Well, I went home plenty of times.
Yeah, no, I know.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then I did that show, and then they hired me for the next show. So I had about 5 months of work. And they were paying me $250 a week, which is more money than, you know, for my first job. And, you know, I figured, well, this is okay. This is okay, and at least it gave me a way into the Chicago theater community.
Well, and what it sounds like is that, I mean, maybe this isn't true, but it sounds like you never actually made the decision to pursue a career in theater. You just sort of followed whatever came up, or... Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and I think there's something about, you know, finding your way to it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then just it sort of emerges.
It emerges, right.
Yeah.
You know, this will be nice to teach in this thing, I'll go and do
right.
that, and then I'll see what happens.
Right.
Right, but not that urgent, you know, no. I must, I will, or I'm on my way to New York, or, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't that for me, and because I was fortunate in a way to have... This family business over here.
Right. Oh, the
saying,
back.
There is
the
a place for you.
There's a place for.
But you. I had worked for my dad in college summers, just to make some extra money. And actually, at the time, he was, I say, working for my father, but my grandfather, his father, was still working and running the business.
Wow.
So, I got to experience what the dynamic of a family business is, and it's very interesting without going into too much detail. But you know, most family businesses don't often last past the third generation.
No, for very good reason.
Because things change. Families get larger, and some people want out, and some, you know, not everyone shares the passion that the founders have for
it. Forgive me, but quite often founders. Are people who begin things and like control and are not that able to delegate or accept another vision, or, I mean, I don't know if that happened in your system.
I don't
system.
Think it was quite that, I think, because the founder was my great-grandfather in 1927. So
wow.
So Peter Moll was his name. The company's called Moll Richardson. He was a Sicilian immigrant when he was a kid, came through Ellis Island. It's that whole immigrant story.
Right.
Gets trained as an electrician in New York, in upstate New York. Starts to work for General Electric. Comes west. He's familiar with the incandescent lighting technology of the time. Comes west, starts to work in the studios, in the film studios for MGM. And then partners up and starts his own company. Developing incandescent lighting technology for motion picture production, which at the time was moving to sound.
Mm-hmm.
So you're building sound stages, so there was some
right there
enormous
at the beginning.
Opportunity.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he starts this factory on Sycamore in Hollywood and not far from Santa Monica and La Brea. And then the company grows through the 20th century.
Right.
As the
the industry.
As filmmaking
right, as the industry
develops,
is growing,
as it's becoming what we know it to be now, and television comes in, so we adapt it there. So by the time I start working for the company, my grandfather was near retirement. My dad is working for him, and observing that, it just didn't feel right for me. It just wasn't a dynamic. It was in the business. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't be performing, and it's a fact. It was a factory, you know, and it's not that I disliked it.
It just didn't feel like
I did have a great affection for it because it's made any number of things possible for me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and our family. So, and yet, I was already charting this path.
Well, you had this thing. Mm-hmm. It's not like you didn't have someplace else to go.
Right.
You know, it's interesting because you said I always had this family business to fall back on, but on the other hand, you had something that another kid might not have had, someplace else that felt real good.
Yeah.
And you could keep going there without ever having to choose.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, you could say, well, I felt, you know, it'd be nice to teach at this thing. I'll go and do that. That'll mm-hmm. feel good. I don't need to decide this. And if this doesn't work out, I can go over here, but I don't need to choose that. And then life picks you up and takes you.
It determines it for you almost.
Yeah,
like it finds, it sort of senses fate, I guess, senses where you really are, what you should be doing.
So I don't think that happens for everybody, but I hear that story a lot.
Yeah,
sometimes even more dramatically than yours, mm-hmm. actually. There's serendipity, that there's, you know, this person chose me, this person picked me out, I happened to be in this place at this time, right?
And I don't. I credit my parents for not discouraging it.
Yes.
Because I'm, in these students I teach, I've taught every summer for, you know, virtually since I was a student in that program at Northwestern, and you come across students who are struggling with the same thing I was struggling with. Is this something that's a possibility? And I, you know, they usually tell them, they ask you questions like, should I go to college and should I double major and should I have something to fall back on? I said, you know what, don't worry about that fall back on stuff.
Right. Good for you.
You have to, I mean, mom and dad will do what they're going to do.
Right.
You know. But if you've gotten this far and they've allowed you to come this far, mm-hmm. they might have sent you here this summer to get it out of your system.
Yes.
Little did
they know. Right?
It's probably going to change you in some really profound way that you'll find your path.
Yeah.
They don't all become performers. Some of them don't even go into theater.
Mm-hmm.
We always think when we're teaching in this program that we're actually creating an audience.
Oh, that's lovely.
If they don't end up as performers or playwrights or directors, and many of them do, or even managing directors of theater companies.
Or stage managers.
Whatever it is, that they end up as audience members.
People who love the theater, who
subscribers,
care. Right.
Donors to theaters.
Right.
And
right.
if you can tap into that passion, that's why I still teach in this program. And I think I was very fortunate in that regard to have parents who weren't really pressuring
to go in
a safe direction.
Do you think that either your mother or your father had any hidden yearning to perform?
I think my mother may have. Mm-hmm. And my mom died 8 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And going back to, I was reminding my dad of this story that production of The Music Man, and they were trying to cast a Marian. And my mom was sort of the producer of the thing. I mean, sort of making it happen at the school and the church to sort of make this sort of production happen. And we were there, and they were there to sing a gal from the parish. Rosemary Simpson was her name. She was there to sing Marian, sort of as an audition, but sort of an informal audition. And my mother was there, and I was there, and Mr. Galley, the director, was there, and he also played the piano. And they had... Richard Galley said, Debbie, why don't you sing Goodnight, My Someone? You know this song. And I remember my mother singing it very tentatively. She could carry a tune, but also being profoundly nervous in doing that. But there's something in that.
Yes.
There was something in that.
Yeah.
I thought, boy, if someone had
done for her what someone
what was done
did
for me,
you.
Perhaps, that maybe it would have unlocked
right.
some form of self-expression.
Yes, yes. And of course,
That she longed for.
Yes.
You know. I'm just speculating, but that's...
No, I think, I suspect that you are mm-hmm. right, and of course, that would be... That would inform how she would feel about you.
I would think so.
You know?
She was devoted to the day she died in coming to Chicago and seeing just about anything I ever did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until she was too ill to do that. But she, man, she was on a plane. She yeah. and my dad, too. You know, mm-hmm. she didn't miss.
Yeah.
She didn't miss. So then I'm in Chicago.
Yeah.
So then I'm in Chicago and starting to get a foothold and getting an agent in Chicago, auditioning for anything. In the early stages of a career, you take just about any job, anything.
Right. you say yes.
Unless you're going to completely compromise yourself.
Right.
Have some dignity.
Right.
But slowly worked my way into the Chicago theater community, mm-hmm. and now it's, you know, it's 21 years later, and I'm firmly established there, and it's leading me in other directions. Of course, Frank Galati has
right.
his connection, very strong connections to Chicago, and Northwestern, and Steppenwolf, and Goodman, where I've worked, so it continues to be as rich a theater community as any in the nation.
Yeah, that's quite clear. And so, and one of the things it did was bring you to Sarasota.
Exactly right.
I wish we had a little bit more Florida weather for you, but...
You know, it's just terrible here.
Yeah,
isn't
right.
it? And it's interesting, it's kind of similar, although the climate can be a little different than Southern California. It is reminiscent of growing up in Southern California, where it's 78 degrees on, you know, in December, on Christmas morning, you know.
I lived in Studio City, actually.
Oh my God, I grew up in Sherman Oaks, right next door. Practically, right?
Right, on the, well, and my sister lived in Sherman Oaks, and my brother lives
yeah.
there now.
Coldwater and Ventura was my stomping grounds, right there.
And I lived in Ventura and Laurel.
Oh, well, you
right.
were practically neighbors.
Right,
yeah.
right. And when I moved there, and then when I moved here, I thought, this is very like what it was like when I moved to L.A.
Mm, mm-hmm.
many years ago, when before everybody in the world moved to L.A.
Yes, well, sure.
You
yeah.
know.
I mean, it's very transient. I mean, it's a place that people move to.
That's right. That's right. Know? And you are, having been born there,
yeah.
you're an anomaly.
And my grandmother was 90, just turned 90, was born
my
there.
My God.
I mean, so... and
this
and,
is truly
and
anomalous.
My, her husband, Warren Parker, his he was born there. I mean, I've got a picture of him, kindergarten picture of him in kindergarten in the 20s.
Wow.
You know, so his father was like a wildcatter at the time. You know, so he was, you know, they were drilling wells out, you know, I don't know, God knows where in Southern California, when it was all orange groves.
Wow.
So that's unusual to
yes.
have that kind of connection to L.A. that goes back that
yeah,
far.
Yeah, that's exactly
so,
right.
Which is cool. So when I hear people sort of diss Los Angeles, mm-hmm. it's often people who've come from somewhere else and don't know it as deeply as a native would.
Yeah.
Who don't see it for all the sort of gloss of the entertainment industry, but see it as actually...
Home.
The home where you were born.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have yeah. the same relationship to New York City. I grew up and lived most of my life in New York.
Yeah.
And people do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, how could you have grown up in New York? You know, it was where I lived.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I get it. I get that, how mm-hmm. people... do that,
yeah.
where that comes
right.
from.
Right, and both L.A. and New York are places where a lot of people want to go. So they come from,
yes.
right, so mostly you have people transplanted from someplace else.
That's
which
right.
is also true of Sarasota.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Since it's, you know, it's Florida.
It's Florida. That's right.
People
That's
like
right.
to retire here or vacation here or both.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, so here you are.
Yeah.
So now I would like to get back to the thing you said at the beginning, which is, that My Fair Lady is such a big production
mm.
that the extra time really helps in terms of rehearsal.
Yes.
So do you want to say something more about that? Because I'm
sure.
not exactly sure what you mean.
When you have a play a musical play like My Fair Lady that's adapted from Pygmalion,
mm-hmm.
adapted from a Bernard Shaw play, with such long stretches of dialogue where there's no song, to have the extra time to talk about what's going on in those scenes, particularly the scenes that, and it's often Higgins and Eliza, to really dig in, and with somebody like Frank with his scholarship,
right,
with his the academic background and the scholarship and his passion for language and his passion for literature, to be able to take the time to dig into those scenes, I think is essential. I think it's essential for any production of My Fair Lady,
right,
if you can allow the time for it. I think it is essential.
But not every director will come to it with the perspective, you know, the historical perspective, the philosophical perspective,
mm-hmm.
that we heard him talk about the other day.
Oh, and so somebody who can speak so well extemporaneously about this play, it was just amazing to witness. So that when you can spend that kind of time, it hopefully will deepen our experience and by extension, of course, engaging the audience maybe on a deeper level than they've ever experienced this particular piece before.
Yeah, that's a really important point, I think. Certainly, Michael Edwards is virtually not interested in doing anything the way other people have done it, you know. And so, so when you think about My Fair Lady, which pretty much everybody has done, you know,
and has some connection to and knows in whatever way that they know.
That's right.
I would not be surprised if there are people in our audience that saw the original production.
No.
Who were maybe New Yorkers and saw it originally.
You know, I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
My parents took us to the theater one by one on our 12th birthday. We were allowed to eat in the restaurant of our choice.
Wow.
And go to something on Broadway.
Fantastic.
And my first show was Kismet.
Okay, sure.
And my sister's first show was My Fair Lady.
See? Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So, whether it was something like that, or you had the soundtrack of the album
right.
on your hi-fi.
Of course, right, right.
You
which,
know,
of course, we did.
Yeah, of course. we all did.
That's right.
And then later on, if you're somebody who knew the film.
Right.
Or rented the film later on, right. or did a production
of it
somewhere.
Right, in school,
right,
perhaps.
Exactly. You've got some, it's become a part of our culture.
That's right, that's right. So everybody's got this preconceived notion of what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be really interesting to see, because I know because of who Michael is and because of what Frank said, that both of them have this idea that they simply do not want to repeat whatever, right?
Right.
They want to make this their own. They want to make it unique.
Well, and they fully embrace the idea that it's not an idea. I think it's true that the ephemeral nature of theater. That when you put a new group of people in a space, even with a play that everyone knows, that kinesthetic in the moment response to this piece of material right now creates it anew.
Yeah, it must needs be different,
yeah.
right?
It has to be if you're truthfully responding in the moment to the material.
Well, that's right. Because you can't be Rex Harrison. You can only be Jeff Parker.
No.
I don't mean that in that one would want to be. I mean that the reality is you have to be Jeff Parker.
Right.
That's who
you want to mind the actors that you have.
That's right.
And so that they connect to the material in the way that they only they can.
They can. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so have you done this play before?
Never.
Okay, good. So do you identify with him at all? Can you find him?
Yes. I can find him. And I think I do identify with Higgins, his savoring of his solitude.
Yes.
how he loves to be surrounded by what makes him feel most comfortable. I think we all do that to a certain extent. For him, it's language. It's the production of language. It's dialect. It's grammar. He's surrounded by the great, in his library, he's surrounded by the great works of Milton and Shakespeare, even the Bible he references. But it also becomes an armor for him. Defense that when the lies is introduced into that situation, it begins to challenge that comfort level. I think on some level in my own life, there are places, maybe we all do this, just there are zones of privacy that are comfortable for us, but that we can also get lost in at the expense of the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
But when something wonderful happens is when it's that private space is intruded upon.
Yes.
But in quite a wonderful way.
But initially it never feels like a wonderful thing.
No. The reaction to it maybe initially is more violent.
Right, you know? Right.
I don't mean violent.
No, you know, I understand. I understand.
But the disruption of that,
mm-hmm,
is what creates the sparks in a play like My Fair Lady.
Yes.
And I think if I personally
conflict,
connect,
right,
with that, that might be the personal connection that I feel with that.
Yeah.
Higgins.
Yeah. That's great. That's great. And of course you've got some of the most wonderful songs ever written.
Oh, come on. I mean, it's just great. I mean, that, you know, Andrea as Eliza gets to sing the most, you know, melodic and expressive stuff.
But
and that Higgins gets all these intense, wordy, singing songs with high velocity in the expression of the language.
Yeah, those are my favorite.
Are they?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a thing for language as well.
Yeah.
And that's all that is, you know. Yeah. I mean, the lovely songs are lovely, okay, good, but...
Yeah.
You know.
It's just, a lot of the ideas of Shaw are expressed through Higgins,
that's
certainly.
Right.
And the romance certainly comes through Eliza in her way. The social commentary is in Doolittle's magnificent speech when he comes into Higgins, and kudos to the adapters Lerner and Lowe to keep that relatively intact from the Pygmalion.
Yeah, you would have someone else.
I'm one of the undeserving poor.
Poor,
he said,
right,
and
it's right.
That's there and is so beautifully expressed, and not in a overly didactic way.
Oh, just, no,
such warmth,
right,
and
that's
humor.
Right. That's right. You love it.
Absolutely.
You love him. Right,
and you
right.
get it. You mm-hmm. get the sort of class struggle.
Right.
Particularly with the English class struggle, which was so pronounced, you know, and you really comes across and sets up well what happens to Eliza and what happens to Doolittle by the end of the play.
Yeah.
So he goes through his own change. You know. It's got something for everybody to connect with.
Yes, that's right. That's what makes good theater,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, so I always ask, having given virtually a life to this work of being an actor, is there anything you want to say about it? About what it feels like, what it means, anything that occurs to you?
I don't think I could be doing anything else. I don't think I'm good at anything else. That's not true. I played golf yesterday. I'm not so bad as a golfer. But I don't think I could do anything else. And I keep thinking back to, you know, when I teach these students every summer, and that if to not let the doubts rule your decision to become an actor. It's if it's something you have to do, you have to do it. And it by doing it, by making that and taking that initial leap, it might lead you somewhere else, even if you don't stay an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But following that initial impulse is so essential, I think.
Yeah.
In whatever path you take. And I think that's what's kept me at it. And I don't think there is a way for me to be fully who I am without being able to fully express myself as an actor on stage.
That is a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Jeff.
You're so welcome.
So you heard it? You'd think that I would be cueing these people with how often they come up with exactly what I expect them to say. I don't think there's a way for me to be fully myself without being an actor on stage. So he found it. He found himself. And if you listened to the whole interview, you know it was a somewhat circuitous route for Jeff. It wasn't a straight through line. It was a lot of happenstance, and this feels okay, and maybe I'll do that. No, that's nice, and wow. But in the end, he knew it when he found it. This is me being fully myself. And that is what I wish for all of you. The recognition, the discovery, the ability to find and demonstrate what it means to be fully yourself. So, as I have said over and over again, this is why I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because this, you hear it over and over from them. I found myself. I found home. I knew I belonged. This was where I always was meant to be. And some of the people I interviewed found that so young. 4, 5, 6, 8. Frank Wildhorn, whose interview I played several weeks ago, said, I put my fingers on the keys. I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew music was my life. Jeff Calhoun, the director of Frank's most current play on Broadway, Bonnie and Clyde, said, I watched those people dancing. I was 4 years old, and I watched those television shows where they were dancing, and I knew that was for me. Kate Alexander, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful director who's assistant director of Florida Studio Theater, said that she sat on a stage while her father talked to an actor when she was 8 years old. She had no idea what went on there, but she knew that that was where she belonged. Who I am, what it means to be fully myself. Okay, running out of time, and I do want to play another song from My Fair Lady. I hope that you all go get to see Jeff and the rest of the cast, who are also amazing. I will be playing an interview I did with Colonel Pickering, Joel Hatch, next week. But in the event that you don't get to see it, I want you to hear another song. If you have never heard the score from My Fair Lady, it's unbelievable. So this song is An Ordinary Man, and we're going to go out on it. But before I do that, I have to thank the intrepid, dependable, cannot do without Josh Hackney for all the help with sound, recording, with getting the show up, on making my computer. If you need any of that kind of help, you want Josh, and you can get him yet again at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. And as always, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show. I know that if you listened to the songs, you heard something delightful. And also, if you listened to Jeff's journey, I hope that you learned something that will make a difference in your life, or even just something that you enjoyed, something that will bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
I find the moment I let a woman make friends with me, she becomes jealous, exacting, suspicious, and a damn nuisance. And I find the moment that I make friends with a woman, I become selfish and tyrannical. So here I am, confirmed old bachelor, and likely to remain so. After all, Pickering, I'm an ordinary man who desires nothing more than just the ordinary chance to live exactly as he likes and do precisely what he wants. An average man am I, of no eccentric whim, who likes to live his life free of strife, doing whatever he thinks is best for him. Just an ordinary man. But let a woman in your life and your serenity is through. She'll redecorate your home from the cellar to the dome, then go on to the enthralling fun of overhauling you. Oh, let a woman in your life, and you're up against a wall. Make a plan and you will find she has something else in mind, and so rather than do either, you do something else that neither likes at all. You want to talk of Keats or Milton, she only wants to talk of love. You go to see a play or ballet and spend it searching for her glove. Oh, let a woman in your life fight eternal strife. Let them buy their wedding bands for those anxious little hands. I'd be equally as willing for a dentist to be drilling than to ever let a woman in my life. I'm a very gentle man, even-tempered and good-natured. Never hear complain, who has the milk of human kindness by the quart in every vein. A patient man am I, down to my fingertips, the sort who never could, ever would, let an insulting remark escape his lips. It's a very gentle man. But let a woman in your life, and patience hasn't got a chance. She will beg you for advice, your reply will be concise, and she'll listen very nicely, then go out and do precisely what she wants. You are a man of grace and polish, who never spoke above a hush. Now all at once you're using language that would make a sailor blush. Oh, let a woman in your life, and you're plunging in a knife. Let the others of my sex tie the knot around their necks. I'd prefer a new edition of the Spanish Inquisition than to ever let a woman in my life. I'm a quiet living man who prefers to spend the evenings in the silence of his room, who likes an atmosphere as restful as an undiscovered tomb. A pensive man am I, of philosophic joys, who likes to meditate, contemplate, free from humanity's mad inhuman noise. Just a quiet living man. But let a woman in your life, and your sabbatical is through. In a line that never ends, come an army of her friends, come to jabber and to chatter and to tell her what the matter is with you. She'll have a booming, boisterous family who will descend on you en masse. She'll have a large Wagnerian mother with a voice that shatters glass. Oh, let a woman in your life. Let a woman in your life. Let a woman in your life. I shall never let a woman in my life.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. lonely ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten